This is a podcast by the Working Group Critical Diversity. I'm Adela Lovrich, member of the group and of the student initiative Common Ground at UDK Berlin. In this episode, I talk with Fatima El-Tayeb, author and professor of literature and ethnic studies at the University of California in San Diego, about questions of migration and racism within the university context and beyond.
Diversidade crítica. Critique diversidade.
Thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation. I'd like to start off with one of your quotes saying, "Racism doesn't need strangers to exist, it produces them." In regard to that and the central topic of your book named Un-German, The Construction of Otherness in the Post-Migrant Society, I'd like to ask you to explain, perhaps through an example, this process through which people of color who live in Germany or in Europe are turned into un-German or un-European strangers.
Sure. Maybe before giving an example to frame it a little bit, this whole construction of people of color has a lot of levels right now, political, but also, of course, it's rooted in this understanding of race as a biological given. So I think it's important to just point out again and again that race is not a biological reality, but a technology of exclusion and hierarchization, which in turn is part of this understanding of Western modernity that pretty much our whole global system is built still, but certainly that's the case in Europe. So that's built around potentially endless set of binaries, right? Male, female, black, white, civilized, primitive, West, East, culture, nature, and so on and so on. And those binaries are presented as opposites, with one side embodying the desirable qualities, the other the undesirable. So it's not arbitrary. They are presented as mutually exclusive. If you have the characteristics identified with, for example, male, you can't also have the ones identified with female, and so on, which obviously doesn't, you know, reflect reality, but it makes reality governable by denying all of the complexities that make life both exciting and difficult. And they all work together, those binaries, to create a system of us versus them, right? That claims that we have all the positive qualities while they lack them. So basically, in reality, of course, there are racialized Germans or Europeans of color, but the ideology says that they are not. So we have to see that in this context where there's an ideology that says there's a certain set of qualities that goes with European, and then there's a certain set of qualities that goes with people of color, and they're supposed to be on opposite sides of that binary, right? So what this ideology does, it creates this chain of meaning where there are certain qualities that are related to Europeanness and related to non-Europeanness, and racialized Europeans represent this uncomfortable reminder that the reality is not in line with the ideology. So what happens is that again and again, the ideology is enforced over the reality. And that could be, and you know, just like these endless questions, if you grow up in Europe as a racialized person, of where do you come from? No, I mean, where do you really come from? So that is not an harmless question that says what you are can't be. You are here, you seem to be what I am, which is a white European, but you can't be, so I have to place you somewhere else, even though you are here. And that goes from this everyday question to racial profiling, right? The idea that the fact that you are here is already unnatural. So you are disciplined, and it's reflected in citizenship laws, right? This idea of jus sanguinis that is based on blood, and this whole notion of blood as something that creates a larger collective is necessarily tied to the idea of race. It doesn't make sense without the notion of race. So it's kind of hard to pin down how this process works because it is present pretty much everywhere in seemingly harmless everyday conversation and in lethal border policies that literally kill people. But the idea of the whole process is to keep intact this us versus them construct, which in turn is built on the fact that we're all aware of that resources and possibilities are divided very unequally across the world. So for those who have, they need a kind of justification, and that's part of the justification. That's one answer to that, but there are, of course, many more.
You wrote about the post-migrant society and Germany in relation to this concept. Can you explain what the post-migrant society is or what it should be?
Well, the term post-migrant is not necessarily my term, so there are different ways of filling it in. It originally came out of an activist context, which basically states all these discussions around whether Germany is a migration society or not are really misplaced because we're already beyond that. So what we should do is to deal with this post-migrant reality that we live in. So that's one way of approaching that. But there's also, I think, a bit of the danger of treating post-migrant like post-racial is treated here in the US. So the idea that we have overcome racism, we live in a post-racial society, and therefore we don't have to talk about structural racism anymore because we're beyond that. So there's a similar idea that now that Germany has accepted its identity as a migrant society, there are no barriers anymore for people with a so-called migrant background. So we don't have to talk about structural exclusion. So yeah, I would say part of the challenges of this kind of neoliberal society that we live in is that certain attempts to create change are not only outright rejected, but also appropriated, right? And of course, this whole discussion about inclusion, diversity, equity is at the kind of in the middle of that, in the middle between pushing for actual change and then appropriating people's attempts for change into something that is more of a PR move. So in that sense, I think post-migrant is a term that in some contexts can be radical, and in others it can be quite the opposite. But what I think the strength is this idea of, again, this binary between citizens and migrants or real Germans and people who still have to prove whether they can eventually become German.
Is it possible to talk about a post-migrant university? And if so, what would that mean, or what would it take for a school like UDK to be post-migrant? What are the adaptation processes that would have to occur?
I don't know. I don't know if that's possible, because one of the, I think, most productive sides of putting this notion of post-migrant into practice is in the context of post-migrant theater. But what that would require to have a structure that you have at, you know, the Ballhaus or Gorky would be a shift of power, right, towards people who have been excluded before. And that is not happening at German universities. German universities are like insanely white and male. And I don't know if you followed the controversy around Professor Maisha Aumer, who stated the obvious, right? There should be no controversy around that at all. But instead, what you have is this bizarre pushback of statements that point to this power imbalance as some kind of anti-white racism, which I think indicates how much universities are still thought to be owned by white men who, of course, in this whole, you know, long line of binaries that has been constructed since the Enlightenment, are invariably on top. So I don't know what exactly universities would have to do, but it would certainly be a lot. I think it would require a real reflection on the foundations that the German, generally European university system is built on internally, but also externally, how much universities as centers of knowledge production have contributed to this larger system of global racial capitalism. So universities like to see themselves, when it's convenient, as this ivory tower, right? Separate from society, just devoted to thinking and pure search for knowledge. But that's, of course, never what they were. What they were driving force behind the creation of this system of exclusion. So I think what would need to happen is an honest confrontation with that history and build on that steps to produce something like reparations as far as that is possible. So a shift in how universities think about the knowledge that they teach, how they think about their own role as knowledge producers in society, and a shift of material power towards the inclusion of those on whose exploitation really this system has been built.
I'd like to go back one step. You mentioned Maisha Maureen Oma. She's a professor, gender studies scholar, and activist. And she had become the victim of a far-right racist campaign earlier this year after an AfD spokesperson accused her of the so-called anti-white racism and, quote, lobbying for immigrants from Africa. Do you think it is possible in some foreseeable future to talk about decentering whiteness?
Well, it depends on what you mean by that, right? Because whiteness has the privilege of being invisible most of the time. So what you would have to do first is make whiteness visible, and then you can decenter it. And I think that's possible, but I think it's also very obvious that this is very uncomfortable for a lot of people. So I don't think it can happen in the context of kind of agreeable, polite conversation. It will be a painful process. So I think there needs to be some pressure, but I don't quite think it's possible, because I think pressure in general is rising, right? And that means pressure from white nationalists who very aggressively claim whiteness as the norm. And there's pressure from those who are tired of that process, and universities are somewhat caught in between. And I think the idea that they can be neutral becomes more and more ridiculous. They are not neutral right now, but they will have to take an explicit stand one way or the other. So I think in some ways, maybe chances are better now than they were a while ago.
Among many other things, you wrote also about how the so-called refugee or migration crisis plays into the construction of the German identity. In one of your texts specifically, you wrote that the plight of refugees has had a frighteningly stabilizing effect on the German identity, and that the so-called Willkommenskultur, or welcome culture, that is being fostered around the arrival of displaced people to Germany actually reveals some old racist wounds. Can you explain these observations?
In terms of the so-called refugee crisis having a stabilizing function, that goes back to this idea of us and them and those binaries, because what is destabilizing to this binary is a constellation where it becomes clearer that the separation between us and them is artificial and is falling apart, or is at least pushed against. So that kind of creates a crisis of identity. And the refugee crisis had the function of recreating clear boundaries. The refugees are on the outside and they want in. And a German we emerged that had the power to decide to let them in or not. That was unquestioned because they are not Germans. We are. So this we is actually quite fractured and quite challenged. But this context allowed it to become more stable again and to suppress challenges to it that were already happening. So in some ways, it's easier to represent yourself as this good German towards a refugee in need than towards a German of color who challenges your privileges. So in that sense, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the idea of welcoming refugees, certainly not, but it doesn't challenge the overall system and it also never lasts. So what I was trying to do in that book is just point out that what I'm not criticizing is the impulse of people to help others that they perceive as a need. But what happens again and again is that there's this hierarchy where I have something and I offer it to you out of generosity. So that doesn't address the issue that I actually have something because you don't. And I am responsible in part, at least for the situation that you're in. So if you approach me with something other than gratefulness, then my welcoming attitude will disappear. Because I don't see us as equals. I see you as something who's asking, and I can say yes or no. And that, for example, plays out when refugees come in and cease to be them and become part of us. Or the children of refugees who are born into Germanness and who are expected to have the same attitude of gratefulness and the same attitude of, I don't really belong here, I'm only here because of your generosity. And when they challenge that, then this culture of welcome time and again flips into the opposite. And I think we have to be honest in admitting that that's what happens, no matter how well-intended this first gesture of welcome is.
On the borders of Europe, there are constantly new devastating developments. People are living in overcrowded camps, such as Moria in Greece or Lipa in Bosnia and many other places, and are being abused by the border police and left there to live in really subhuman conditions. And now, of course, everything is complicated even more by the pandemic. At the same time, Europe and also specifically Germany has all the capacities to help and still chooses to look the other way. In one of your lectures, you said something very interesting. You said that the northwest of Europe instrumentalizes this humanitarian crisis to condemn the south and southeast of Europe, to blame Greece and Bosnia and other countries for what is happening there in order to legitimize its own racism. Can you please expand on this?
I think that's a kind of structure that goes beyond the borders of Europe that has to do with the position of Turkey, for example, as negotiating its power as the country that can keep out refugees from Europe, but also wants more connection with Europe. And the whole notion of Europe, again, it's just not a geographical reality that is there. It's something that was constructed. So the idea of the borders of Europe seem, for example, very clear, but they're not. Borders are always shifting. And there are certain parts of Europe that can claim Europeanness in part because of their geographical location, but in huge part also because of this story of what Europe is, what exemplifies Europe, what makes Europe so different from the rest of the world. And there are certain places like Germany who at this point do not have to question their Europeanness. Germanness in many ways exemplifies Europeanness. And then there are those nations that are located at what is considered the borders of Europe in the south and in the east, and their Europeanness is much more in question. So they have to prove it on the one hand by enforcing the borders, by reminding everyone why the border is here, why Greece, why Spain is part of Europe. But what's beyond that is not, for example. And at the same time, the violence that comes out of protecting Europe, European borders, is localized. The narrative is not, well, this is where people first enter. The story is, well, things like that, this kind of violence would never happen in Germany, which of course is bullshit. It happens there because exactly those nations are not quite as European as Germans are. Eastern European nations missed a lot of liberal development because they were under the influence of the Soviet Union. Nations like Spain and Greece are not only surrounded by Europeans, but also by all these non-European nations. So their culture is not as European as ours. And again, coming back to that binary, Europe is civilized, progressive, non-violent. So whenever Europe is not that, it must be because wherever that happens is not really Europe. And you even have that inside of Germany, right? Where this idea is that racist violence is either perpetrated by disturbed individuals who don't represent Germany because they're not normal, or is represented by Eastern Germans who, again, are not really that European because of that non-European Soviet influence. So that's the other thing. Borders of Europeanness are, on the one hand, enforced geographically in the south and in the east, but the borders can also pop up in the middle of Europe. So part of what happens with non-Europeanness is that it's wherever people are who are defined as not properly European. So this is why Germany at the same time can claim that it's more welcoming, more civilized than Bosnia or Greece. But at the same time, it also has to claim that all those people who were let in generously by Germans will forever remain non-German.
What do you see as a solution to this current entanglement of crisis that disproportionately affects those in the most precarious positions, like people in refugee camps, for example?
The necessary thing is to get rid of this binary construction and get rid of this assumption that this is all a zero-sum game. If they have more, then I will have less. Which is how Europe functioned for a long time, starting with colonialism at least. But it's of course not true, and it becomes very obvious now that it's not true, because the rest of the world and Europe have always been interconnected in this attempt to keep out the negative consequences of this approach to the rest of the world by Europe, which was one of exploitation, is falling apart more and more. I mean, that is very obvious with the pandemic, for example. You know, usual measures of border control do not work in that case. But that doesn't really need so far to a change in approach, right? The idea is that everybody in the rich West gets vaccinated and then we can move on, and the rest of the world, well, we see. Well, what we'll see with that is, of course, that people will not and never have accepted this hierarchy that places them at the bottom without resistance. Because, again, this hierarchy is one that is lethal. It is very explicitly also about which lives are worth saving and which lives are not worth saving. And it's bizarre to assume that those who are defined as not worth saving would just accept that and drop dead. They won't. So the only solution is to understand that for the West to survive, it has to give up its greed. And in terms of practical steps to that, I don't know if the fact that clearly there will be no survival if the West continues the way it is enough to understand that sharing resources in a different way is what's necessary. But that, I think, would be the only way. And I think the potential is in an intersectional approach to all these issues, where it becomes clear that environmental justice is connected to racial justice, is connected to migration justice. And out of that, build a model that is not us versus them, but us in various constellations, right? So in order for that to happen, Europe as it is, not as, you know, Europeans, but as an idea, has to disappear. So that is that, but I think that's something that's going to happen anyway. So either Europe with all its power can play a productive part in that or not, but it's inevitable.
I'd like to come back to the context of the university and ask how, in your opinion, can universities support displaced people or support them better without the white saviorism and paternalizing?
In some ways, that leads back to this question again of, can the master's house be dismantled with the master's tools, right? So if what needs to happen is the dismantling of the master's house, can you use it to actually achieve this process? And I think potentially yes. I think maybe what we have to do is first to look at those master's tools and see if they really have been created by the master or just claimed and appropriated by him. And if so, can we use them differently? Can we use the existing tools and combine them to new tools? And I do think that even though maybe universities need to be abolished eventually, meanwhile, I think we can use them because in many ways they are still spaces of privilege in the sense that they have not yet been completely subjected to a neoliberal logic. So they can be spaces of thinking about another world. And I think in very practical terms, what they can do is to offer resources, offer fellowships, offer new kinds of studies, something like critical refugee studies that is slowly being integrated somewhat in the university system. In some places here in the US, and the system of the University of California, for example, at the initiative of scholars who are refugees themselves or who are the children of refugees. So what that speaks to is to the problem that in the US, universities were fundamentally reshaped after or as an effect of the civil rights movement, and then liberation movements, the Black liberation movement, the women's liberation movement, the queer liberation movement. So what they achieved was to open the universities to a certain extent to populations who had been almost completely excluded before, sometimes legally, through explicit racial segregation. But that was achieved through massive pressure and through the willingness, short term, but at least for a while, on the side of governments, for public universities to establish affirmative action. So that was an in for people, and that created a space where people could create something new. And that never happened in Germany or anywhere else in Europe. So the problem is that the master's house, in this case, the universities, is still very firmly in the hand of the master. There are very few inroads. And I don't know if they can be created without a massive movement. like the one that existed in the US, it just created so much pressure that change needed to happen. So there would be, I think there would be many ways, many things that the universities could do. But the question is, will they do it? Will they be forced to do it? Because again, that US universities have, you know, things like Black studies, like ethnic studies, is not due to the fact that they're more enlightened or whatever. It's because, you know, they had to make that step. And European universities definitely should make that step too. But in order to do that, there would have to be a kind of self-awareness that I don't really see. I mean, at least speaking for German universities, not to be rude, but I feel like in many ways they are just stuck in, I don't even know which century. Certainly they're not in the present. But there's this kind of ownership still of this tradition of enlightenment, of thinking, of knowledge that makes some kind of self-critical analysis very, very hard. So I think that's not the way to go. The way to go is to just push the people there. But again, it's really hard when you have like people like Maisha being like one of the very, very few Black professors in Germany speaking out and then being massively attacked and receiving very little support, not from students or even faculty, but from university leadership, right? So yeah, it's a challenging situation. And it's also, you know, there's also this huge hypocrisy because a lot of this resistance against models like the ones in the US is built on the idea that, you know, talking about critical race theory, that doesn't, you know, there's no place for that in Germany because we don't really have race here. We don't have this history, so we don't need all these things. But surprisingly, the backlash that you have here against all these developments can be translated into German context very easily. So those people, the white nationalist right, but also the white national liberals who do not want to think about whiteness and power, can talk about cancel culture, can talk about political correctness. And suddenly that's not, you know, a kind of US discourse that doesn't apply to Germany. But what this discourse actually responds to, this kind of massive challenge to white privilege, has not even happened yet in Germany. And already there's the backlash. So I think that emphasizes both that this is a very important point where it's really painful, but also one where there's a ton of resistance.
In the discussions about diversity and anti-discrimination in the US, people often point out the difference between equity and equality. To my knowledge, this is not a common point of debates in Germany. Here we actually have parties like AfD launching racist campaigns, like the one against the professor Maisha Maureen Omer, who rightly criticized the lack of diversity at German universities and the underrepresentation of Black people and people of color. So it doesn't seem like there is any consideration of equity, but I'd still like to ask you to share your thoughts and your experiences with equity in practice in the university or other institutional frameworks.
Well, yeah, in some ways that leads back to what I just said about affirmative action, right? Which is an equity model that pays attention to history and context. Because giving everybody the same thing or the same opportunities doesn't mean that they're actually on an equal playing field, because the whole playing field is built on inequality. So what equity does is to acknowledge that the system as it is not fine. Equality assumes the system as it is, it's great, but for some reason that we're kind of left behind us, not everybody had access to this awesome system. So we open it up and let more people in, and then the problem is solved. Equity assumes that the system itself is problematic because it created this inequality. It needed this inequality to function. So if you let more people in, you just shift the inequality. you don't abolish it. In order to abolish it, you have to look at the structures that produce inequality and change them. So the backlash that I mentioned before was directed, for example, at affirmative action. And here at the University of California, where I'm teaching, as far as I know, that was the first university system in which affirmative action was abolished through popular vote. What we have here in California is if you get enough signatures, you can put something on the ballot and then people can decide on it. And in 1992, affirmative action in California was abolished, which severely affected students of color, in particular Black and Latinx students, but even more so, it affected small businesses by people of color that had received support before that, with the understanding that those businesses had explicitly been excluded from opportunities before. So it was not enough to just say, you can have that opportunity right now. You can just offer your services to people. It was an acknowledgement of structural barriers that had to be overcome. And since then, a lot has happened. But we just had in this last election a ballot measure that suggested that affirmative action would be reintroduced, at least at the level of the University of California. And even if when you ask people, do you think it makes sense to account for historical inequalities by doing this or that, the majority of people says yes, as soon as you frame it as a racial question, the vast majority of white people votes against it. So this is what happened here. Because the argument was, well, why do you want to take something away from me? You can give those people whatever you want, but, you know, why do I have to suffer from it? So it's, again, this zero-sum idea that assumes if everybody has access to resources, that means that the ones who already have access will lose something, which also indicates that, you know, people know that there's something wrong with that model. That's why they're afraid. So I think one of the challenges is to make the argument, which is based in fact, that people will win, whoever they are, whether they're white, people of color, whether they're male, female, but instead you have a lot of catering to this idea, yes, of course, white men are scared because they are losing. So what is happening on the level of the university is kind of a complicated issue. This attempt to kind of have this argument of affirmative action means everybody wins, don't worry about it, failed. So there's still too much resistance. But at the same time, what is happening in response to the huge Black Lives Matter protests last year is that universities, or at least the University of California, had a PR issue. Because of course, the universities here see themselves also as these institutions of knowledge production, of fairness, of openness. So there was a lot of lip service to, we are outraged about the situation, this is terrible. And then there was a level of, we understand that we haven't done enough yet, so we will do more. So then the challenge for students and faculty of color and everybody who's in support of them is to use this opening and to push them towards change. So in some ways, it means that you have to be strategic. I still think it kind of emphasizes that there's still the power of the street, because a lot of, you know, leftist discourse moves towards that's not something that's working anymore. You can't get people out in the street anymore. And even if they go out there, that doesn't really have that much of an impact. I don't think that's true. But I do think that the system has become much more sophisticated in trying to position themselves as open to critique without changing a lot. So, I don't know. I mean, it depends. We had huge student process and protests a little more than 10 years ago at my university in San Diego, led by Black students, based on very typical, explicit racist frat parties, and the university basically saying, well, that's not our problem. And the students made very clear that, yes, it was the university's problem because this fake neutrality didn't work. In not intervening, they took a stand against Black students. And the Black students' undergrads made that claim very clearly, and they received a lot of support from others. So that initiated some structural change that I think is useful. We have, I don't know what she's called, Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And this, you know, a lot of what her job is to make the university look good. But at least she's there. So in thinking about the German situation, I feel like on the one hand, I can be very critical of the ways in which equity is kind of marketed here. At the same time, even to have that would be a huge step for German universities. So I think what could happen also is, because Germany is so much behind, is for people in Germany to learn from the process here and to try to avoid some of those pitfalls. But I definitely see it as a huge advantage that this kind of discussion, or this attempt to suppress a discussion, that you have in Germany right now, exemplified by the case around Maisha Auma, you can't have that here. You can have a lot of pushback and people saying, well, we did enough already, and now it's time to take care of the white men, blah, blah, blah. But it's not possible to just say, well, we're not talking about that.
Last year, we had student protests following the Black Lives Matter movement. Students at the UdK spoke out about their experiences of discrimination. They made demands to the university and engaged in different ways against intersectional discrimination. I was wondering if you can talk about some other strategies of resistance that you experienced in an academic setting.
This experience that I briefly mentioned right now, the student protests here 10 years ago, were really, really interesting for me on the one level to see how intersectional the students' approach was, but then also in seeing how that was dismantled, not only by the administration, but also by supposedly supportive faculty, which very much pushed the line of saying, well, this is only about race. There are other issues too, but if we want to be successful, we can't address them right now. We have to focus on race. One of the many problems with that was that the students who were really at the center of the protests, who were doing a lot of the exhausting work, were mostly women and or queer. So their obvious intersectionality was denied in that whole debate. And their approach, which was both based on their lived experience of intersecting oppressions, was then deemed irrelevant or even a hindrance to achieving success. So I think one of the challenges with strategies of resistance is, on the one hand, to know that you don't have to reinvent the wheel and to look at movements earlier, but then also try to not repeat the same mistakes and not necessarily, you know, on the one hand, listen to people who have experience and to learn from their experience, but then also to not listen to them when they say, well, we did it like this, so you have to do too. And I do think there's more of an awareness of the need to be intersectional among younger activists, which I think is really, really great, because it both is a much better approach to finding an end into dismantling this intersecting system of oppressions. And of course, it creates strength in numbers because it includes a lot more people. But it is an approach that still faces a lot of resistance from an older generation of progressive activists as well. That is a challenge. But I think that that plays out in many contexts. Another one that that is relevant here, not because of my work at the university, but at the, because the university and San Diego itself is located on the border to Mexico. I think it's one of the San Diego Tijuana border is one of the busiest borders in the world, and one that of course is at the center of these of this extremely violent border regime that already existed earlier under Obama and before, but then completely escalated, of course, under Trump. And now the challenge is to keep people aware of the fact that the system in itself is still as destructive as ever, and to mobilize people. And one of the ways in which we try to achieve that is to focus very explicitly on the migrant detention center here at the border on the US side, and focus on closing that down, knowing that, you know, if you close that one center down, that you don't solve the problem, but you solve the problem for everybody who's imprisoned there right now. And you can create a model for other local campaigns. And in order to make clear that this is not a problem that only affects a few people, we are thinking about ways to show in which this detention center is very, on many levels, very directly connected to questions of anti-Blackness, to questions of settler colonialism, to questions of environmental justice. So try to bring in people from where they already are and not kind of adding something else to it, but just point out, well, you're working on this, you're really passionate about environment, well, then you should be really passionate about closing down this detention center. So I think this kind of local focus with an intersectional approach is one of the ways to create coalitions, be it inside or outside of the university.
This was my last question, so thank you so much for this insightful conversation.
Thank you. I hope it was helpful.